us, Olive said. I'm strong enough.
No way, Enoch said. You're tiny, and there are too many of us.
The tower rocked sickeningly. Ceiling tiles crashed down around us, and cracks spidered through the floor.
Fine, then, Olive said. Stay behind.
She started upstairs. It took the rest of us only a moment, and one more wobble of the tower, to decide that Olive was our only hope. Our lives were now in the dainty hands of our smallest member. Bird, help us. We ran up the sloping hallway, then out into open air and what remained of the day. Below us spread a commanding view of Devil's Acre, the compound and its pale walls, the misty chasm and its hollow-gapped bridge, the black tinders of Smoking Street and the packed tenements beyond, and then the ditch, snaking along the loop's edge like a ring of scum. Whatever happened next, whether we lived or died, I'd be happy at least to see the last of this place. We bellied up to the circular railing. Emma gripped my hand.
Don't look down, eh?
One by one, the Imbrins turned into birds and perched on the rail, ready to help however they could. Olive took hold of the railing with both hands and slipped out of her shoes. Her feet bobbed upward until she was doing a weightless headstand on the rail, her heels aimed at the sky.
"Bronwyn, take my feet!" she said. "We'll make a chain. Emma grabs Bronwyn's legs, and Jacob Emma's legs, and Horace Emma's, and Horace Hugh's."
"My left leg's hurt," Hugh said.
"Then Horace will grab your right one,"
Olive said.
"This is madness," said Sharon. "We'll be much too heavy."
Olive started to argue, but a sudden tremor shook the tower so hard that we had to cling to the rail or be shaken off. It was Olive's way or nothing.
"You get the idea," Miss Peregrine shouted. "Do as Olive says, and, most importantly, don't let go until we reach the ground."
Little Olive bent her knees, kicked one foot down toward Bronwyn, and offered it to her. Bronwyn took Olive's foot, then reached up and grabbed the other one. Olive let go of the rail and stood up in Bronwyn's hands, pushing toward the sky like a swimmer kicking off the wall of a pool. Bronwyn was lifted off her feet. Emma quickly grabbed hold of Bronwyn's legs, and then she was lifted too, as Olive strained upward, gritting her teeth, willing herself higher. Then it was my turn, but Olive, it seemed, was running out of lift power. She struggled and groaned, dog-paddling toward the sky, but she was out of juice. That's when Miss Peregrine turned into a bird, flapped into the air, hooked her talons through the back of Olive's dress, and lifted. My feet came off the ground. Hugh grabbed onto my legs and Horace onto his legs and Enoch onto his and so on, until even Perplexus and Addison and Sharon and his cousins had caught a ride. We strung out into the air like a strange, wiggling kite, millered its invisible tail. The other smaller Imbrins hooked into our clothes here and there and flapped furiously, adding what lift they could. The last of us had only just left the tower when the whole thing began to crumble. I looked down in time to see it fall. It happened quickly. Tumbling in on itself, the top section seeming to implode as if it had been sucked into the collapsing loop. After that, the rest just went, tipping over in one section before breaking in the middle and slumping into a huge cloud of dust and debris, the sound like a million bricks being poured into a quarry. By then, Miss Peregrine's strength was flagging, and we were falling slowly toward the ground, the Imbrins pulling us hard to one side for a soft landing away from the wreckage. We touched down in the courtyard, Millard first, and then finally Olive, who was so spent that she landed on her back and stayed there, breathing like she'd just run a marathon. We gathered around, cheering and applauding her. Her eyes got big and she pointed up.
Look!
In the air behind us, where the top of the tower had been just moments before, there spun a small vortex of shimmering silver, like a miniature hurricane. It was the last of the collapsing loop. We watched, hypnotized, as it shrank, spinning faster and faster. When it became too small to see, there issued from it a sound like the crack of a sonic boom.
Alma!
And then the whirlwind winked out, sucking Call's voice away with it. Chapter 10. After the loop collapsed and the tower fell, we weren't allowed to stand shell-shocked and gaping, at least not for long. Though it seemed the worst dangers were behind us, and most of our enemies had been felled or captured, there was chaos all around and work to be done. Despite our exhaustion and bruises and sprains, the Imbrins set about doing what Imbrins do best, which was to create order. They changed into human form and took charge. The compound was searched for hidden whites. Two surrendered outright, and Addison discovered another, a miserable-looking woman hiding in a hole in the ground. She came out with her arms raised, begging for mercy. Sharon's cousins were employed constructing a makeshift jail to hold our small but growing number of prisoners, and they set happily to work, singing while they hammered. Sharon was interrogated by Miss Peregrine and Miss Avocet, but after just a few minutes of questioning, they were satisfied that he was merely a mercenary, not a secretive operative or a traitor. Sharon had seemed as shocked by Bentham's betrayal as the rest of us. In short order, the whites' prisons and laboratories were emptied, and their machines of terror smashed. The subjects of their horrible experiments were brought out into the open and attended to. Dozens more were freed from another block of cells. They emerged from the underground building where they'd been held, looking thin and ragged. Some wandered in a daze and had to be corralled and watched, lest they walk away and get lost. Others were so overwhelmed by gratitude that they couldn't stop thanking us. One small girl spent half an hour going from one peculiar to another, surprising us with hugs.
"You don't know what you did for us," she kept saying. "You don't know what you did."
It was impossible not to be affected by it, and as we gave them what comfort we could, we were beset by sniffles and sighs. I could not begin to imagine what my friends had been through, much less those who'd spent weeks or months in Call's keeping. Compared to that, my bruises and traumas were inconsequential. The rescued peculiars I'll remember most were three brothers. They seemed in fair health, but were so shocked by what they'd experienced that they would not speak. At the first opportunity, they retreated from the crowd, found a bit of rubble to hunker on, and stared hollowly around them, the oldest with his arms stretched around the younger two, as if they could not quite square the scene before them with the hell they had accepted as reality. Emma and I crossed to where they were sitting.
"You're safe now," she said gently.
They looked at her as if they didn't know the meaning of the word. Enoch saw us talking to them and came over with Bronwyn. She was dragging a barely conscious wight behind her, a white-coated lab worker with his hands tied. The boys recoiled.
"He can't hurt you any more," Bronwyn said. "None of them can."
"Maybe we should leave them here with you a while," said Enoch with a devilish grin. "I'll bet you'd have a lot to talk about."
The wight shifted his head. When he saw the boys, his blackened eyes widened. "Stop it," I said. "Don't torment them." The youngest boy's hands curled into fists, and he started to get up, but the oldest boy held him back and whispered something in his ear. The younger boy closed his eyes and nodded, as if putting something away, then tucked his fists tightly under his arms.
"No, thank you," he said in a polite southern drawl.
"Come on," I said, and we let them be, Bronwyn dragging the wight along behind her. We milled about the compound, awaiting instructions from the Imbrins. It was a relief, for once, not to be the ones who decided everything. We felt spent but energized, exhausted beyond belief, but charged with the crazy knowledge that we had survived. There were spontaneous bursts of cheering, laughter, songs. Millard and Bronwyn danced across the scarred ground. Olive and Claire clung to Miss Peregrine, who carried them in her arms as she buzzed around, checking on things. Horace kept pinching himself, suspicious that this was just one of his dreams, some beautiful future that hadn't yet come to be. Hugh wandered off by himself, no doubt missing Fiona, whose absence had left a hole in us all. Millard was busy fretting over his hero, Perplexus, whose rapid aging had stopped when we entered Abaton, and, strangely, not yet resumed. But it would, Millard assured us, and now that Call's tower was destroyed, it was unclear how Perplexus would reach his old loop. There was Bentham's Panlupticon, of course, but which of its 100 doors was the right one? Then there was the matter of Emma and me. We were attached at the hip and yet hardly exchanged a word. We were afraid to talk to each other, I think, because of what we had to talk about. What would happen next? What would become of us? I knew Emma couldn't leave Peculiardom. She would have to live inside a loop for the rest of her life, be it Devil's Acre or some other better place. But I was free to go. I had family and a home waiting for me. A life, or the pale approximation of one. But I had a family here, too. And I had Emma. And there was this new Jacob I had become, was still becoming. Would he survive back in Florida? I needed all of it. Both families, both Jacobs, all of Emma. I knew I would have to choose, and I was afraid it would split me in half. It was all too much, more than I could face so soon after the trials we'd just endured. I needed a few more hours, a day, to pretend. So Emma and I stood shoulder to shoulder and looked outward, throwing ourselves into whatever the Imbrins needed of us. The Imbrins, overly protective by nature, decided we'd been through enough. We needed rest, and besides, there were tasks, they said, that peculiar children had no business taking part in. When the tower fell, it had crushed a smaller building beneath it, but they didn't want us combing the wreckage for survivors. Elsewhere in the compound, there were Ambro vials to be recovered, which they didn't want us going near. I wondered what they'd do with them, or if those stolen souls could ever be reunited with their rightful owners. I thought about the vial made from my grandfather's soul. I'd felt so violated when Bentham used it, and yet, if he hadn't, we never would have escaped the Library of Souls.
So, in the end, really, it was my grandfather's soul that had saved us. It was gratifying to know that at least it had not gone to waste. There was work to be done outside the White's compound as well. Along Loose Lane and elsewhere in Devil's Acre, enslaved peculiar children needed to be freed, but the Imbrins insisted they should be the ones to do it, along with some peculiar adults. As it happened, they would face no resistance. The slavers and other turncoats had fled the acre the moment the Whites fell. The children would be collected and brought to a safe house. The traitors hunted down and brought before tribunals. None of this was our concern, we were told. Right now, we needed a place to recuperate, as well as a base of operations from which the reconstruction of peculiardom could begin. And none of us wanted to stay in the White's fear-haunted fortress any longer than we had to. I suggested Bentham's house. It had tons of space, beds, facilities, a live-in doctor, and a panopticon, which, you never know, might come in handy for something. We moved as dark was falling, loading one of the White's transport trucks with those of us who couldn't walk, the rest marching behind it. We crossed out of the fortress with a little help from the bridge hollow, which lifted the truck across the gap first, and the rest of us in groups of three. Some of the kids were frightened of the hollow and needed coaxing. Others couldn't wait and clamored for another ride once they'd crossed. I indulged them. My control over hollows had become second nature, which was satisfying, if slightly bittersweet. Now that hollows were nearly extinct, my peculiar ability seemed obsolete. This manifestation of it, anyway. But I was okay with that. I didn't care about having a showy power. It was just a party trick now. I'd have been much happier if hollows had never existed. We traveled through Devil's Acre in a slow procession, those of us on foot surrounding the vehicle like a float in a parade, others riding its bumpers and roof. It felt like a victory lap, and the Acre's peculiars flooded out of their homes and hovels to watch us pass by. They had seen the tower fall. They knew things had changed. Many applauded. Some gave salutes. Others lurked in the shadows, ashamed of the role they'd played. When we arrived at Bentham's house, Mother Dust and Rinaldo met us at the door. We were welcomed warmly and told the house was ours to use as we needed. Mother Dust immediately began treating the injured, showing them to beds, making them comfortable, anointing them with dust. She offered to heal my bruises and the bite wounds across my stomach first, but I told her I could wait. Others were worse off. I told her how I'd used her finger, how it had saved my life and the lives of others. She shrugged it off and turned back to her work. I insisted. "You deserve a medal," I said. "I don't know if peculiars give medals, but if they do, I'll make sure you get one." She seemed taken aback by this somehow, and let out a choking sob before hurrying away. "Did I say something wrong?" I asked Rinaldo. "I don't know," he said, concerned, and went after her. Nim meandered about the house in a daze, unable to believe what Bentham had done.
"There must be some mistake," he kept repeating. "Mr. Bentham would never betray us like that."
"Snap out of it," Emma said to him. "Your boss was a slimeball."
The truth was a bit more nuanced, I thought, but making an argument for the complexity of Bentham's moral character wasn't going to make me terribly popular. Bentham didn't have to give up that recipe or take on his monstrous brother. He made a choice. In the end,
he'd damned himself in order to save the rest of us.
"He just needs time," Sharon said of Nim. "It's a lot to process. Bentham had a lot of us fooled."
"Even you?" I said.
"Me especially."
He shrugged and shook his head. He seemed conflicted and sad.
"He weaned me off ambrosia, pulled me out of addiction, saved my life. There was good in him. I suppose I let that blind me to the bad."
"He must have had one confidant," Emma said. "You know, a henchman, an Igor." "His assistant," I said. "Has anyone seen him?"
No one had. We searched the house for him, but Bentham's stone-faced right-hand man had disappeared. Miss Peregrine gathered everyone together and asked Emma and me to describe him in detail, in case he returned.
"He should be considered dangerous," she said. "If you see him, do not engage. Run and tell an Imbrin."
"Tell an Imbrin,"
Enoch muttered.
"Doesn't she realize that we saved them?"
Miss Peregrine overheard him.
"Yes, Enoch. You were brilliant, all of you. And you've grown up remarkably. But even grown-ups have elders who know better."
"Yes, miss," he said, chastened.
Afterward, I asked Miss Peregrine if she thought Bentham had planned to betray us from the beginning.
"My brother was an opportunist above all else," she said. "I think part of him did want to do the right thing. And when he helped you and Miss Bloom, he did so genuinely. But all along he'd been making preparations to betray us, in case that turned out to be advantageous for him. And when I told him where to stuff it, he decided that it was."
"It wasn't your fault, Miss P," said Emma. "After what he did to Abe, I wouldn't have forgiven him either.
Still, I could have been kinder."
She frowned, her eyes wandering.
"Sibling relationships can be complex. I wonder sometimes if my own actions had some bearing upon the paths my brothers chose. Could I have been a better sister to them? Perhaps, as a young Imbrin, I was too focused on myself."
I said, "Miss Peregrine, that's..." and then stopped myself from using the word ridiculous, because I'd never had a brother or sister, and maybe it wasn't. Later, we took Miss Peregrine and some of the Imbrins down to the basement to show them the heart of Bentham's panopticon machine. I could feel my hollow inside the battery chamber, weak but alive. I felt awful for it, and asked if I could take it out, but Miss Peregrine said that for now they needed the machine working. Having so many loops accessible under one roof would allow them to spread news of our victory quickly throughout Peculiardom, to assess the damage done by the whites, and to begin rebuilding.
"I hope you understand, Mr. Portman," said Miss Peregrine.
"I do."
"Jacob has a soft spot for that hollow," Emma said.
"Well," I said, a little embarrassed, "he was my first." Miss Peregrine looked at me strangely, but promised she'd do what she could. The bite wound across my stomach was becoming too unbearable to ignore, so Emma and I joined the line to see Mother Dust, which snaked out of her makeshift clinic in the kitchen and down the hall. It was amazing to watch person after person hobble in, battered and bruised, nursing a broken toe or a mild concussion, or in Miss Avocet's case, a bullet from Call's antique pistol lodged in her shoulder, only to stride out a few minutes later, looking better than new. In fact, they were looking so good that Miss Peregrine pulled Rinaldo aside and asked him to remind Mother Dust that she was not a renewable source, and not to waste herself on minor wounds that would heal just fine on their own.
"I tried to tell her myself," he replied, "but she's a perfectionist. She won't listen to me."
So Miss Peregrine went into the kitchen to have a word with Mother Dust in person. She came out again 5 minutes later, looking sheepish, several cuts on her face having disappeared, and her arm, which hadn't hung straight since Call had slammed her into that cavern wall, swinging freely at her side.
"What a stubborn woman!" she exclaimed.
When it was my turn to go in and see her, I almost refused treatment. She only had a thumb and forefinger left on her good hand. But she took one look at the zagging, blood-encrusted cuts across my belly, and practically shoved me onto the cot they'd set up by the sink. The bite was becoming infected, she told me through Reynaldo. Hollow teeth were crawling with nasty bacteria, and left untreated, I would get very sick. So I relented. Mother Dust sprinkled her powder across my torso, and in a few minutes I was feeling much improved. Before I left, I tried to tell her again how much her sacrifice had meant, and how the piece of herself she'd given to me had saved us. Really, without that finger, I never would have been able to... But she turned away as soon as I started talking, as if the words, "thank you," burned her ears. Reynaldo hurried me out.
"I'm sorry. Mother Dust has many other patients to see."
Emma met me in the hall.
"You look marvelous," she said. "Thank the birds. I was really starting to worry about that bite."
"Be sure and tell her about your ears," I said.
"What?"
"Your ears," I said louder, pointing to them. Emma's ears hadn't stopped ringing since the library. Because she'd had to keep her hands aflame to light our way as we escaped, she hadn't been able to block out the terrific noise, which, I worried, had literally been deafening.
"Just don't mention the finger."
"The what?"
"The finger," I said, holding up my finger. "She's very touchy about it. No pun intended."
"Why?"
I shrugged.
"No idea."
Emma went in. 3 minutes later, she came out snapping her fingers by her ears.
"Amazing," she said. "Clear as a bell."
"Thank goodness," I said. "Shouting is no fun."
"Ha! I mentioned the finger, by the way."
"What? Why?"
"I was curious."
"And?"
"Her hand started shaking. Then she mumbled something Reynaldo wouldn't translate, and he practically chased me out."
We might have pursued it further, I think, if we hadn't been so tired and hungry, and if at that moment the smell of food had not wafted its way past our noses.
"Come and get it!"
Miss Wren shouted from down the hall, and the conversation was tabled. As night fell, we gathered to eat in Bentham's library, the only room big enough to hold all of us comfortably. The fire was stoked, and a feast donated by grateful locals brought in, roast chicken and potatoes and wild game and fish, which I avoided on the off chance they might have been caught in the ditch. We ate and talked and rehashed the adventures of the past few days. Miss Peregrine had heard only a little about our journey from Cairnholm to London, and then across bombed-out London to reach Miss Wren, and wanted to know every last detail. She was a great listener, always laughing at the funny parts and reacting with satisfying gasps to our dramatic flourishes.
"And then the bomb fell right on the hollow and blew it to smithereens," Olive cried,
leaping out of her chair as she reenacted the moment.
"But we had Miss Wren's peculiar sweaters on, so the shrapnel didn't kill us."
"Oh, my heavens," Miss Peregrine said. "That was very lucky."
When our stories had finished, Miss Peregrine sat quietly for a time, studying us with a mixture of sadness and awe.
"I'm so very, very proud of you," she said, "and so sorry for all that happened. I can't tell you how much I wish it had been me by your side, and not my deceitful brother."
We observed a moment of silence for Fiona. She wasn't dead, Hugh insisted, but merely lost. The trees had cushioned her fall, he said, and she was probably wandering in the forest somewhere near Miss Wren's menagerie, or had knocked her head on the way down and forgotten where she came from, or was hiding. He looked around hopefully at us, but we avoided his eyes.
"I'm sure she'll turn up," Bronwyn assured him.
"Don't give him false hope," Enoch said. "It's cruel."
"You would know about cruel," Bronwyn replied scornfully. "Let's change the subject," Horace said. "I want to know how the dog rescued Jacob and Emma in the underground."
Addison hopped gamely onto the table and began to narrate the story, but he embellished it with so many asides about his own heroism that Emma was forced to take over. Together, she and I told them how we'd found our way to Devil's Acre, and how, with Bentham's help, we'd mounted our mini-invasion of the White's compound. Then everyone had questions for me. They wanted to know about the Hollows.
"How did you teach yourself their language?" Millard asked.
"What's it like to control one?" asked Hugh.
"Do you imagine you're one of them, like I do my bees?"
"Does it tickle?" asked Bronwyn. "Do you ever wish you could keep one as a pet?" asked Olive.
I answered as best I could, but was feeling tongue-tied because it was a hard thing to describe, my connection with the Hollows, like piecing together a dream the morning after. I was distracted, too, by the talk Emma and I had been putting off. When I'd finished, I caught Emma's eye and nodded to the door, and we excused ourselves. As we walked away from the table, I could feel the eyes of the room on our backs. We ducked into a lantern-lit cloakroom cramped with coats, hats, and umbrellas. It was not a spacious or comfortable place, but it was at least private, somewhere we wouldn't be walked in on or overheard. I felt suddenly and irrationally terrified. I had a difficult choice to make, one I had not fully grappled with until now. We were silent for a moment, facing each other, the room so deadened by fabric that I thought I could hear the beating of our hearts.
"So," Emma said, because of course she would start first.
Emma, always direct, never afraid of an awkward moment.
"Will you stay?"
I did not know what I would say until the words left my mouth. I was running on autopilot, no filter. "I have to see my parents." That was unquestionably true. They were hurting and frightened and didn't deserve to be, and I had left them dangling too long.
"Of course," Emma said. "I understand. Of course you do."
A question hung in the air, unasked. "See my parents" had been a half measure, a non-answer. See them, sure. And then what? What would I say to them? I tried to imagine telling my parents the truth. In that regard, the phone conversation I'd had with my father in the underground had been a preview of coming attractions. "He's lost it. Our son is insane, or on drugs, or maybe not on enough drugs."
No, the truth wouldn't work. So what? I would see them, assure them I was alive and well, make up a story about sightseeing in London, then tell them to go home without me? Ha! They would chase me. They'd have cops hiding in the bushes at our meeting place. Men in white coats with Jacob-sized nets. I'd have to run. Telling them the truth would only make things worse. Seeing them only to run away again would torture them more. But the idea of not seeing my parents at all, of never going home again, I couldn't get my mind around it. Because if I was really being honest with myself, as much as it hurt to think about leaving Emma and my friends in this world, part of me wanted to go home. My parents and their world represented a return to sanity and predictability, something I was longing for after all this madness. I needed to be normal for a while, to catch my breath, just for a while. I had repaid my debt to the Peculiars and Miss Peregrine. I had become one of them, but I wasn't only one of them. I was also my parents' son, and as imperfect as they were, I missed them. I missed home. I even sort of missed my dumb, ordinary life. Of course, I would probably miss Emma more than any of those things. The problem was, I wanted too much. I wanted both lives, dual citizenship, to be peculiar and learn everything there was to learn about the peculiar world, and to be with Emma and explore all the loops Bentham had catalogued in his Panlopticon, but also to do the stupid, ordinary things normal teenagers do, while I could still pass for one. Get my driver's license, make a friend my own age, finish high school. Then I'd be 18 and I could go anywhere I wanted, or any when. I could come back. Here was the truth, the root and bone of it. I couldn't live the rest of my life in a time loop. I didn't want to be a peculiar child forever. But one day, maybe, I could be a peculiar adult. Maybe, if I was very careful, there was a way to have it all. "I don't want to go," I said. "But I think I might need to. For a while." Emma's expression flattened.
"Then go," she said.
I was stung. She hadn't even asked what a while meant. "I'll come visit," I said quickly. "I can come back any time." Theoretically, this was true. Now that the white menace had been crushed, there would, bird willing, always be something to come back to. But it was hard to imagine my parents signing off on more trips to the UK any time soon. I was lying to myself, to both of us, and Emma knew it.
"No," she said. "I don't want that."
My heart dropped.
"What?"
I said quietly.
"Why not?" "Because that's what Abe did. Every few years he'd come back. And every time he was older and I was the same. And then he met someone and got married."
"I wouldn't do that," I said. "I love you."
"I know," she said, turning away. "So did he."
"But we're not. It won't be like that with us." I grasped blindly for the right words, but my thoughts were a muddle.
"It would, though. You know I'd go with you if I could, but I can't. I would age forward. So I'd just be waiting for you, frozen in amber.
I can't do that again. It wouldn't be long, just a couple of years, and then I could do what I wanted. I could go to college somewhere, maybe here in London.
Maybe, she said. Maybe. But now you're making promises you might not be able to keep, and that's how people in love get very badly hurt.
My heart was racing. I felt desperate and pathetic. Screw it. I'd never see my parents again. Fine. But I couldn't lose Emma. I wasn't thinking straight, I said. I didn't mean it. I'll stay.
No. I think you are being honest, she said. I think if you stay, you won't be happy. And eventually you'll come to resent me for it. And that would be worse.
No. No, I would never. But I'd shown my hand, and now it was too late to take it back.
You should go, she said. You have a life and a family. This was never supposed to be forever.
I sat down on the floor, then leaned back into the wall of coats and let them swallow me up. For a few long seconds I pretended none of this was happening, that I wasn't here, that my entire world was woolen and black and smelled of mothballs. When I surfaced again to breathe, Emma was sitting cross-legged on the floor beside me.
"I don't want this either," she said. "But I think I understand why it has to be. You have your world to rebuild, and I have mine."
"But it's mine too now," I said.
"That's true,"
she thought for a moment, kneading her chin.
"That's true, and I very much hope you do come back, because you've become a part of us, and our family won't feel whole without you. But when you do, I think you and I should just be friends."
I thought about that for a moment. Friends. It sounded so pale and lifeless. I guess it's better than never talking again.
"I agree," she said. "I don't think I could bear that."
I scooted next to her and put my arm around her waist. I thought she might pull away, but she didn't. After a while, her head tipped onto my shoulder. We sat like that for a long time. When Emma and I finally emerged from the cloakroom, most everyone was asleep. The hearth in the library was burned down to embers, the platters overflowing with food reduced to scraps, the room's high ceilings echoing with contented snores and murmurs. Kids and Imbrins lay draped across couches and curled upon the rug, even though there were plenty of comfortable bedrooms upstairs. Having nearly lost one another, they weren't about to let go again so soon, even if just for the night. I would leave in the morning. Now that I knew what had to happen between Emma and me, a longer delay would only torment us. Right now, though, we needed sleep. How long had it been since we'd closed our eyes for more than a minute or two? I couldn't remember feeling more exhausted. We piled some cushions in a corner and fell asleep, holding each other. It was our last night together, and I clung tight, my arms locked around her, as if by squeezing hard enough I could lock her into my sense memory. How she felt, how she smelled, the sound of her breathing as it slowed and evened. But sleep pulled me down hard, and it seemed I'd only just closed my eyes, when suddenly I was squinting against glaring yellow daylight
pouring in from a bank of high windows. Everyone was awake and milling around the room, talking in whispers so as not to disturb us. We untangled ourselves in a hurry, self-conscious, without the privacy of the dark. Before we'd had a chance to compose ourselves, in breezed Miss Peregrine with a pot of coffee and Nim with a tray of mugs.
"Good morning, all. I trust you're well rested, because we've got lots of..."
Miss Peregrine saw us and stopped mid-sentence, her eyebrows rising. Emma hid her face.
"Oh, no."
In the exhaustion and emotion of last night, it hadn't occurred to me that sleeping in the same bed as Emma, even if sleeping is all we did, might offend Miss Peregrine's Victorian sensibilities.
"Mr. Portman, a word."
Miss Peregrine set down the coffee pot and crooked a finger at me. Guess I was taking the rap for this one. I stood up and smoothed my rumpled clothes, color rising in my cheeks. I wasn't ashamed in the least, but it was hard not to feel a little embarrassed.
"Wish me luck,"
I whispered to Emma.
"Admit nothing,"
she whispered back. I heard giggles as I crossed the room, and someone chanting,
"Jacob and Emma sitting in a tree, Y-M-B-R-Y-N-E.
"Oh, grow up, Enoch," said Bronwyn. "You're just jealous."
I followed Miss Peregrine into the hall. "Nothing happened," I said, "just so you know."
"I'm sure I'm not interested," she said. "You're leaving us today, correct?"
"How did you know?"
"I may, strictly speaking, be an elderly woman, but I've still got my wits about me. I know you feel torn between your parents and us, your old home and your new one, or what's left of it. You want to strike a balance without choosing sides, and without hurting any of the people you love. But it isn't easy, or even, necessarily, possible. Is that about the size of it?"
"It's... yeah, that's pretty much it."
"And where have you left things with Miss Bloom?"
"We're friends," I said, testing the word uneasily.
"And you're unhappy about it?"
"Well, yeah. But I understand, I think." She cocked her head.
"Do you?"
"She's protecting herself."
"And you,"
Miss Peregrine added. "That I don't get."
"You're very young, Jacob. There are many things you're not likely to get."
"I don't see what my age has to do with it."
"Everything!"
She laughed, quick and sharp. And then she saw that I really didn't understand, and she softened a bit.
"Miss Bloom was born near the turn of the last century," she said. "Her heart is old and steady. Perhaps you worry she'll soon replace you, that some peculiar Romeo will turn her head. I wouldn't count it likely. She's fixed on you. I've never seen her as happy with anyone, even Abe."
"Really?" I said, a surge of warmth building in my chest.
"Really. But as we've established, you're young. Only 16. 16 for the first time. Your heart is just waking up, and Miss Bloom is your first love. Is she not?"
I nodded sheepishly. "But yes, undoubtedly, anyone could see it."
"You may have other loves," Miss Peregrine said. "Young hearts, like young brains, can have short attention spans."
"I don't," I said. "I'm not like that." I knew it sounded like something an impulsive teenager would say, but at that moment, I was as sure about Emma as I'd ever been about anything, Miss Peregrine nodded slowly.
"I'm glad to hear that," she said. "Miss Bloom may have given you permission to break her heart, but I have not. She's very important to me, and not half as tough as she lets on. I can't have her mooning about and setting things on fire should you find yourself distracted by the feeble charms of some normal girl. I've been through that already, and we simply haven't the furniture to spare. Do you understand?"
I said, caught off guard. "I think so." She stepped closer and said it again, her voice dropping low and stony.
"Do you understand?"
"Yes, Miss Peregrine." She nodded sharply, then smiled and patted my shoulder.
"Okay, then. Good talk."
And before I could respond, she was marching back into the library and calling out,
"Breakfast!"
I left an hour later, accompanied to the dock by Emma and Miss Peregrine, and a full complement of our friends and Imbrins. Sharon was waiting with the new boat left behind by fleeing ditch pirates. There was a long exchange of hugs and tearful goodbyes, which ended with me promising I would come and see everyone again, even though I didn't know how I'd manage that any time soon, what with international flights to pay for and parents to convince.
"We'll never forget you, Jacob,"
Olive said, sniffling.
"I shall record your story for posterity," Millard promised. "That will be my new project. And I'll see that it's included in a new edition of the Tales of the Peculiar. You'll be famous!"
Addison approached with the two Grimbear cubs trailing him. I couldn't tell if he had adopted them or they him.
"You're the fourth bravest human I've ever known," he said. "I hope we'll meet again."
"I hope so, too," I said, and meant it.
"Oh, Jacob, may we come and visit you?" begged Claire. "I've always wanted to see America."
I didn't have the heart to explain why it wasn't possible. "Of course you can," I said. "I'd love that." Sharon rapped his staff on the side of the boat.
"All aboard!"
Reluctantly, I climbed in, and then Emma and Miss Peregrine boarded too. They had insisted on staying with me until I met my parents, and I hadn't put up a fight. It would be easier to say goodbye in stages. Sharon unmoored the boat, and we pushed off. Our friends waved and called to us as we floated away. I waved back, but it hurt too much to watch them recede, so I half-closed my eyes until the current had taken us around a bend in the ditch, and they were gone. None of us felt like talking. In silence, we watched the sagging buildings and rickety bridges pass. After a while, we came to the crossover, were sucked rudely through the same underpass by which we'd entered, and spat out the other side into a muggy, modern afternoon. The crumbling tenements of Devil's Acre were gone, glass-fronted condos and shining office towers risen up in their place. A motorboat buzzed past. The sounds of a busy, preoccupied present day filtered in. A car alarm, a cell phone ringing, jangly pop music. We passed a fancy canal-side restaurant, but thanks to Sharon's enchantment, the diners on the patio didn't see us as we floated by. If they had, I wondered what they would have thought of us. Two teenagers in black, a woman in Victorian formal wear, and Sharon in his grim reaper cloak, pulling us out of the underworld. Who knows? Maybe the modern world was so jaded that no one would have batted an eye. My parents were another story, though, and now that we were back in the present, just what that story would be was starting to concern me. They already thought I'd lost my mind or gotten into hard drugs,
I'd be lucky if they didn't ship me off to a mental hospital. Even if they didn't, I'd be doing damage control for years. They would never trust me again. But it was my struggle, and I would find a way to deal with it. The easiest thing for me would be to tell them the truth. But again, I couldn't. My parents would never understand this part of my life, and to try and force them to could land them in a mental hospital. My dad already knew more about the peculiar children than was good for him. He'd met them all on Cairnholm, though he'd thought he was dreaming. Then Emma had left him that letter and a photo of herself with my grandfather. As if that weren't bad enough, over the phone I'd actually told my dad I was peculiar. That had been a mistake, I realized, and selfish. And now, here I was heading to meet them with Emma and Miss Peregrine at my side. "On second thought," I said, turning to them in the boat, "maybe you shouldn't come with me."
"Why not?" Emma said. "We won't age forward that quickly."
"I don't think my parents should see me with you. This is all going to be hard enough to explain as it is."
"I've given some thought to this," said Miss Peregrine.
"To what, my parents?"
"Yes. I can help you with them, if you like."
"How?"
"One of an Imbrin's myriad duties is dealing with normals who become problematically curious about us, or otherwise troublesome. We have ways of making them uncurious, of making them forget they've seen certain things."
"Did you know about this?" I asked Emma.
"Sure. If it wasn't for the wipe, peculiars would be in the news every other day."
"So it wipes people's memories?"
"It's more a selective cherry-picking of certain inconvenient recollections," said Miss Peregrine. "It's quite painless and has no side effects. Still, it may strike you as extreme. I leave it to your discretion."
"Okay," I said.
"Okay what?" said Emma.
"Okay, please do the memory wipe thing to my parents. That sounds amazing. And while you're at it, there was this time when I was 12 that I crashed my mom's car into the garage door."
"Let's not get carried away, Mr. Portman."
"Just kidding," I said, though I'd only sort of been. Either way, I was hugely relieved. Now I wouldn't have to spend the rest of my adolescence apologizing for the time I ran away, made my parents think I was dead, and nearly ruined their lives forever. Which was nice.
Chapter 11. Sharon dropped us off at the same dark, rat-infested underjetty where we'd first met him. Stepping off his boat there gave me a twinge of bittersweet nostalgia. I may have been terrified and filthy and in various exotic forms of pain every second of the last several days, but I would probably never have an adventure like this again. I would miss it. Not so much the trials I'd endured, as the person I'd been while I endured them. There was an iron will inside me, I knew that now, and I hoped I could hang on to it, even as my life grew softer.
"So long," Sharon said. "I'm glad I met you, despite all the endless trouble you caused me."
"Yeah, me too." We shook hands. "It's been interesting."
"Wait here for us," Miss Peregrine said to him. "Miss Bloom and I will be back within an hour or two."
Finding my parents turned out to be easy. It would have been even easier if I'd still had my phone, but as it was, all we had to do was report to a police station. I was a known missing person, and within half an hour of giving an officer my name and sitting down on a bench to wait, my mother and father arrived. They were wearing rumpled clothes that had clearly been slept in. My mother's normally perfect makeup was a mess. My dad had a 3-day beard,
and they were both holding stacks of missing posters with my face on them. I felt instantly and comprehensively awful for what I'd put them through, but as I tried to apologize, they dropped the posters and wrapped me in a two-way hug, and my words were